Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Larry Noble, Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics, who examines the collapse of Enron and the enormous influence the company purchased through millions of dollars in campaign contributions. Bill Goodfellow of the Center for International Policy, who analyzes the Bush administration's controversial appointment of Otto Reich as Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs. And Michael Dolan of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who discusses protest actions being organized to greet delegates of the World Economic Forum as they gather in New York City at the end of January. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The World Press Review magazine reports that a new high-stakes energy standoff could be building in Central Asia, with the dismantling of the Taliban regime and the placement of American military bases throughout Afghanistan. Major oil companies like ExxonMobil and British Petroleum are updating plans to exploit the 80 billion barrel energy reserve in Central Asia. These plans include taking a new look at several pipeline projects, including one that would go from the ex-Soviet republics through Afghanistan towards Pakistan. According to diplomats and energy executives in Asia, such a move could upset Russia and China and raise the global profile of border disputes between Iran, Turkmenistan, and Azerbaijan to Cold War dimensions. An oil analyst in the energy-rich Caspian Sea noted, soon the U.S. will be playing a major role in these disputes. The September 11th terrorist attacks put all talk of oil development in Central Asia on hold. The heated conflict in Kashmir also has had negative consequences for new projects. But expectations are changing. Energy exploitation will soon be back on the agenda, with the general feeling that Central Asia has been neglected for too long. It will be the third time that the great powers have tried to play the great game over the fate of resource-rich lands of Central Asia. Growing up, Cambodian family planning advocate Hen Satha, now in her 40s, did not learn much about abortion until a friend in high school suddenly died from an illegal procedure. Later on, Satha witnessed a lot more suffering working as a midwife in a refugee camp on the Thailand-Cambodian border. According to the news magazine In These Times, conditions have recently improved in Cambodia, where abortions were legalized in 1997, and there is a growing focus on improving women's health. Yet these gains could be lost in the wake of President George Bush's gag order that stops U.S. funding to international groups that provide abortion counseling. Health workers in Cambodia now admit it is very difficult to talk to our clients about abortion services. To complicate the situation, Cambodia is now in the nexus of a major public health crisis, with an exploding HIV/AIDS infection rate, growing infant mortality, and the percentage of pregnancy-related deaths among women that is among the highest in the world. With little access to safe abortions, many Cambodian women are turning to cheaper alternatives such as traditional midwives who try to kill a fetus with her fingers, or use the Chinese pill, a homemade remedy that often results in hemorrhaging. With aid now cut off by the Bush administration, pregnant women are suffering the consequences in Cambodia. Just last year, 2,000 Cambodian women died from unsafe abortions. Mother Jones magazine reports that Utah oilman Earl Holding is looking to strike gold during the Winter Olympic Games. As owner of the Snow Basin Ski Resort, Holding won a $14 million contract to hold such high-profile events as the men's and women's downhill races. Holding has also won several other lucrative concessions from the U.S. government. The federal government agreed to pay for a road going from his ski resort to the Salt Lake City Airport. In addition, Holding used the upcoming Olympics to win a 1,300-acre land swap in 1996 that will allow the resort owner in years to come to build luxury condos, hotels, and a golf course. Holding started pushing for a land swap in the mid-1980s, but was turned down by the U.S. Forest Service. With the Olympics coming, he won the backing of top Utah Republican Congressman James Hansen and Senator Orrin Hatch, who put the land swap into the 1996 public lands bill. In the process, Holding gave Hansen and Hatch tens of thousands of dollars in campaign contributions. The land swap and Holding's manipulation of the Winter Games has Utah residents grumbling and asking tough questions about government corporate corruption and influence peddling. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
The recent collapse of the Enron Energy Corporation, the single largest bankruptcy in U.S. history, has provoked many questions about who knew what and when in the Bush administration, as the company's chairman contacted key government officials in the weeks before Enron failed. But while the White House says no favors were given to Enron, many employees and small investors were financially wiped out, as the company's top executives, aware of Enron's dire situation, avoided losses by selling their stock worth $1.1 billion. The connection between the Bush administration and Enron are many. Kenneth Lay, Enron's chairman, was among the top political contributors to Bush's presidential campaign. Vice President Dick Cheney sought Lay's advice in secret meetings to formulate the administration's energy policy. Attorney General John Ashcroft, a recipient of Enron campaign contributions, was forced to recuse himself from a Justice Department investigation into Enron's collapse. And President Bush recently chose Mark Roskow, a lobbyist for Enron, to chair the Republican National Committee. While Republicans received about 73% of Enron's $5.8 million in political contributions since 1989, Democrats, too, have benefited from the energy giant's quest to buy influence. Among the latest revelations to surface was the admission by Enron's accounting firm Arthur Andersen that it destroyed thousands of documents related to the bankruptcy. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Larry Noble, executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics, who examines the collapse of Enron and the investigations now underway to determine the extent to which political corruption played a role in this monumental business failure.
Well, from a campaign finance standpoint, it's a good case study of what is happening in Washington and around the country. What you have with Enron is a corporation that had become a moderately big player in the political field, giving out campaign contributions, trying to buy access with those campaign contributions, and it would have probably continued doing what it was doing if it had not run into this major problem of a bankruptcy. And what that bankruptcy has done is really shine spotlight on Enron and also the contributions it's given, and frankly has a lot of politicians running for cover right now.
In terms of Enron's connections with the politically powerful in Washington, D.C., they've been most closely identified with the Bush White House, but they've certainly given out tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars to Democrats as well. Maybe you could speak to the kind of player they were and the kinds of influence that they tried to acquire with all these campaign contributions.
Well, it's interesting. Enron was not the top political player. In fact, it's in the top 50 of, if you look at corporations and labor unions in terms of donations, they're in the top 50. And that's important to keep in mind because what we're going to discuss about Enron in many ways is going to be true about a lot of corporations. And it just gives you some insight into the political process. Since the 1990 election cycle, Enron has contributed about $6 million to political candidates. Now, many corporations give to both Republicans and Democrats. Some tend to lean one way or the other. Enron has given to both Republicans and Democrats, but about 73-74% of its money has gone to Republicans. It has also been a big supporter of President Bush's campaign. And Ken Lay, the CEO of Enron, was also a supporter of President Bush, both back in Texas and once he came to Washington. And in fact, it goes even beyond that. Vice President Cheney had an energy task force which met, and it's become somewhat controversial since they refused to release the details of the energy task force. But the reports are that Enron or Ken Lay met with the energy task force about six times. So, and this is the task force that was deciding energy policy for the United States. And that's some of the stuff that you get to buy with your political contributions.
As we look to Congress to investigate the Enron collapse and the political connections there, who among Democratic leadership also received contributions from Enron who may be a little less than honest brokers in looking into the scandal?
Well, there are a number of people. You can start with the Texas delegation. Ken Benson, a Democrat from Texas, received was actually the largest recipient between 89 and 2000, receiving money from Enron. Sheila Jackson Lee from Texas also received a lot. And she's a Democrat. Martin Frost, a Democrat from Texas. Now, it's not surprising, frankly, to see that they first help out their home state people. On the Senate side, you have Kay Bailey Hutchinson, who's a Republican, and Phil Gramm, who's a Republican. If you go down, though, the fourth largest recipient of Enron money was Charles Schumer from New York, who received almost $22,000 in Enron money. The problem is the political contributions that start the process, and whether people are thinking because of those political contributions, I've got to come down extra hard, or because of those political contributions, I've got to lay off, the problem is the political contributions are going to impact the process.
Now, when it comes to the congressional investigation, optimally, what would you like to see come out of it in terms of maybe some precedent-setting changes in the way America does business or the oversight process of, through the Securities and Exchange Commission?
One of the things I would like to definitely see come out of it is a full and complete investigation. And this may be too much to hope for in an election year, but one that isn't just driven by partisan screaming back and forth, but are really, really getting to the bottom of this. I think some of the issues that are going to be on the table include Arthur Anderson. I mean, we haven't talked about that, but there's obviously coming out in the news every day, Arthur Anderson destroyed documents. What did Arthur Anderson know? What's the relationship of these accounting firms that also do consulting? Are they really independent auditors at this point, or are they just merely consultants who become flacks for the companies? There was an attempt in the past to regulate these type of firms, and in fact, Arthur Anderson had lobbied against that, and they won that lobbying battle. I think you're going to see a real cry now to regulate those type of businesses. There's obviously going to be a real look into investments. Retirement investments people make in their own company, and there's some talk about limiting how much an individual can put or how much they can invest in the company that they work for, because here you see what happens, or the danger of what happens. It's be interesting to see the effect this has on President Bush's call for privatization of Social Security. Here you see some of the dangers that brings about. So I think it's going to. I think in the end, hopefully, it will start a debate about this whole issue about privatization, about what should be done with these retirement plans, and also about corporate responsibility, what the responsibility of a corporation is to its shareholders, to its workers, and what the responsibility of accounting firms like Arthur Anderson is.
That was Larry Noble, Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics. Contact the center by calling area code 202-857-0044. Or visit their website at www.opensecrets.org. Last week, President Bush made a recess appointment of Otto Reich as Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs. Bush had first announced Reich's appointment last March, but ran into intense opposition among Senate Democrats. Among the reasons they were opposed was Reich's tenure in the early 1980s as head of the Reagan administration's Office of Public Diplomacy, where he worked directly with Oliver North, producing propaganda to influence U.S. public opinion in support of the Contra War against Nicaragua's Sandinista government. 3 years later, his office was closed down by Congress as an illegal operation. Reich, a Cuban-American with many ties to anti-Castro groups in Miami, later served as ambassador to Venezuela, where he wrote letters in support of a visa application for Orlando Bosch. Bosch is a convicted terrorist who is responsible for the bombing of a Cuban airliner in which 73 civilians were killed. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Bill Goodfellow, Executive Director of the Center for International Policy. He discusses why Bush appointed Reich, his lack of support in Congress, and some of the important regional issues Reich will be responsible for in his State Department post.
Reich's record was so notorious. Most of us who follow Latin America were just amazed that the administration would put him forward. And a number of times, this has been going on a long time, his name surfaced February 15th in the Washington Post. And on the 9th of March, the New York Times did a large expose of Reich that would have sunk any candidate, linking him to all sorts of misdeeds in the past. And it looked like his candidacy was over, but astonishingly, they kept him in there. And then finally, on the 12th of July, Reich's name was formally sent to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. In other words, he was formally nominated. But most people at the time realized there was no way this guy was going to get through. The Democrats were adamantly opposed to him, in particular Senators Biden and Dodd of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. But I think there was consensus in the Democratic Party. And a good number of Republicans, including Republicans on the committee, also opposed Reich. So it was just clear that he wasn't going anywhere. In fact, Senator Dodd refused to hold hearings until the administration provided the documents that he was asking for,